Okay, so we're continuing. We started last time the Psalms of Ascent. There's a little subsection in this last book of the Psalms. And now we're to Psalm 122, which is, as you'll see, it's about Jerusalem, the city, which they've come to at the end of their pilgrimage. And this is a song of delight in their city. The author, playing on the sound of the word Jerusalem, Yerushalayim, he divides the song into two parts, as you'll see. In part one, which is the first five verses, he meditates really on the sound of Yeru, that part of it, Yeru, which is, well, I'll explain it. And then in the second half, he plays with or reflects on the Salem part of the city. So he's doing this. Now, there are indications of the same play on the name Jerusalem in many places, in the Psalms, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, Zechariah. So it was obviously a favorite thing for them to do, to take the name of the city. For example, I'll give you one that you might be interested in, Sydney. Now, I find I'm stunned by the number of people who don't know what Sydney means. St. Denis, thank you. I'm also stunned by those who do know. Saint Denis, Sydney is Saint Denis. Saint Denis, the patron saint of France, Saint Denis. But it's named after Lord Sydney, who got his name, you know, but that's what it means. Similarly, with Jerusalem, I don't know the meaning of Canberra, you may. Place of meeting. Well, there we are. So you can imagine someone who loved Canberra, like all of you do, and I do, playing on that idea. Well, that's what they're doing here in this psalm. The first section then on the first part of the name Jerusalem. Yeru derives from the Hebrew verb yara, which means to lay stones, to found a city, for example. Literally to lay stone. It's similar in sound to the Hebrew word for a city, ir, yeru, yir. Jerusalem is simply called the city in Ezekiel 7:23 and Psalm 87. And before I start the psalm, I'll read from the book of Tobit in chapter 13, where he eulogizes the city. My soul blesses the Lord, the great King, for Jerusalem will be built as his house for all ages. How happy I will be if a remnant of my descendants should survive to see your glory and acknowledge the King of heaven. The gates of Jerusalem will be built with sapphire and emerald, and all your walls with precious stones. That might remind you of the book of Apocalypse, the book of Revelation. The towers of Jerusalem will be built with gold, and their battlements with pure gold. The streets of Jerusalem will be paved with ruby and stones of Ophir. No one knows yet for certain where Ophir is, but it was one of the trade areas, some say in the northern part of Africa, some say Saudi Arabia, some say India. They just haven't finally got it tied down. But anyhow, gold of Ophir was the best gold you could get. The gates of Jerusalem will sing hymns of joy, and all her houses will cry, Alleluia, blessed be the God of Israel, and the blessed will bless the holy name forever and ever. So our psalm begins, verse 1. What joy when they said to me, let's go to the house of Yahweh. And now our feet are standing within your gates, O Jerusalem. Some of you may have been on pilgrimage and you know the feeling of arriving in a holy city or wherever you might happen to be. And the first verse is obviously about the invitation to come. And the second verse is they arrive and they're delighted to be in the holy city. And verse 3 goes on to say, Jerusalem, built as a city so unified and compact. To it all the tribes go up, the tribes of Yahweh, as was decreed for Israel, to give thanks to the name of Yahweh. And whenever you read Yahweh, you know what to do, I hope by now. You know to think of the burning bush and the name by which God is named there in that redemptive action of sending Moses to redeem my people from Egypt. So it's always the God of history, the God who, as they saw it anyhow, intervened in history to save the poor and the downtrodden. So it takes you right to the very heart of the Hebrew concept of God, the key concept, the liberator God, who cares for the poor, hears the cry of the poor. It's always got that Exodus redemption feeling about it. And I always spell it just the four consonants, just to transliterate the way the Hebrew is written in the Bible. But most translations today follow the Greek and say the Lord, which I don't fancy as a good translation, so I don't do it. Is that all right? So, after the destruction of the northern kingdom in 721 BC, Jerusalem was the main cultic centre for all who worshipped Yahweh. It was the only one left, really. Bethel and Shechem and Dan and other ones had been just taken over by the Assyrians. And all the refugees came down, and Jerusalem, where the temple was, and it was in Judah. So from the Jewish point of view, that was the only real high place or sacred site. So they reimagined a lot of this literature, which some of it may have come from the north. The book of Deuteronomy, for example, chapter 16 reads, 3 times a year all your males shall appear before Yahweh, your God, at the place that he will choose. So they're reading back, of course, to Moses, and Moses, at Moses' time, Jerusalem wasn't a sacred site, it was still owned by a pagan lord, you know. So they're obviously carefully writing it, and no doubt that was in Dan. They would have seen the place God chose to be Dan, up in the north, eh? In another place, they would have seen it as Bethel, or Shiloh, or Shechem, or Beersheba, wherever, depending on what part of the Palestine they were in. But it gradually gets linked into Jerusalem. At the festival of unleavened bread, at the festival of weeks, that's Pentecost, of course, and at the festival of booths, they shall not appear before Yahweh empty-handed. So they had to bring their sacrifices. And you can see from Jerusalem point of view, this is quite a money spinner, because everyone had to come to Jerusalem, so there's a little bit of control going on here. Verse 5 of our psalm, for there the throne for judgment was set up, the throne of the house of David. So not only was Jerusalem a center for cult worship, it was the center for administration of justice. And that's what happened in the temple. And now this very simple psalm in the second part plays on the second part of the word Salem, Shalom, Salam, you're all used to that, peace. So in verse 6 it says, pray for the peace, the shalom of Jerusalem. You can hear it. Pray for the peace of Jerusalem. May they prosper who love you. Isaiah 66 reads, rejoice with Jerusalem. Be glad for her, all you who love her. Rejoice with her in joy, all you who mourn over her. But what an interesting clash there is with Jesus weeping over the city, Matthew 23:37. Jerusalem, Jerusalem, the king, the city that kills the prophets and stones those who are sent to it. How often have I desired to gather your children together as a hen gathers her brood under her wings, and you were not willing. You wouldn't accept the way of peace. Verse 7, peace be within your walls and security within your towers. An obvious prayer. And Psalm 48 has a similar prayer. Walk about Zion. Zion is the city Jerusalem from the point of view of the place where the temple is and where the Davidic dynasty rules. So it's a political rather than a geographic name for the same locality. So walk about Zion, go all round it, count its towers, consider well its ramparts, go through its citadels, that you may tell the next generation that this is God, our God, forever and ever. He'll be our guide forever. But once again, note a contrast. The Book of Lamentations, written as a dirge or a lament because of the destruction of the city by the Babylonians in 587. And this is written, I don't know, might be a century later, I'm not sure. Chapter 2 of Lamentations reads, the Lord has scorned his altar, disowned his sanctuary. He's delivered into the hand of the enemy the walls of her palaces. A clamor was raised in the house of Yahweh as on a day of festival. Yahweh determined to lay in ruins the wall of daughter Zion. He stretched the line. He did not withhold his hand from destroying. He caused rampart and wall to lament, and they languished together. This mentality is still well alive. Take the latest catastrophe in Pakistan, you know, and some of the comments being made by some of the Muslim people there. There must be a blessing in this. We don't know why, but God has obviously got some beautiful thing to offer through this destruction of this place. So to get it, it's still back in the idea that God is running the world and organizing chaos and winning wars and winning battles. It's all there. It's all through the Old Testament scriptures. All through. They never got beyond that insight or lack of insight, oversight, till Jesus, when it gets shattered by the crucifixion. Because you can't possibly believe that God organized the crucifixion of Jesus, you know, and the innocent one. He couldn't have sinned. Do you get at me? It shattered people. But isn't it interesting how all that thought thinking came sneaking back into theology later? Because I think I might have been taught as a child that God willed Jesus to die so that we'd be saved. So once again, we put God in the Pilate seat organizing the crucifixion, which is an absolute horror. But we did it because it's very hard to get away from this. We seem to want someone to control us. So if we're afraid, we run for cover. We vote for some political party that's going to, you know, look after the workers forever. Read my lips. And, you know, all this stuff goes on and on and on. But we're very vulnerable to it. Hope you're not. We have to dare to be human beings. And we have to dare to believe that God is actually love, not control. And they don't work together. And love doesn't mean God is not doing anything. But it means that everything that happens in this world, which is free, I'm free, you're free, limited, but so are the rocks free, so is the plasma free, you know. So that's all happening. Well, I don't know whether freedom is the right word to use, but it's not a bad word to use. It's got its own creative energies that are created, and God is loving this world that we're in. But that's it, and that's massive to love, but not controlling it. And not organizing. See, God didn't destroy Jerusalem in 587. It was the Babylonian army, and they had better ammunition and they had more military. So of course they won. Isn't that how it works? Verse 8. For my family and friends, I pray for your peace. Still playing on the Salem part of Jerusalem. And here you've got Luke, Jesus, to the disciples. For the house, whatever house you enter, first say peace to this house. Shalom. And I hope you remember, but anyhow, you may know. Shalom in Hebrew is my best image for it, and I think it picks up the key point, is an orchestra where you've got every instrument playing to perfection. Shalom doesn't mean quiet, it means absolute, filled with life, but very sensitive. So a peaceful parish is where everybody's ministering, everybody's got a gift, but they're not pushing and they're not pulling, they're listening to others. You know, I mean, it's just a wonderful cooperative effort of energy that is harmonious. That's peace.
There's another lovely Jewish song. I can't remember all the words, but my father sent me the words once. It says, "May peace surround you as peace, like the peace of a farm, and the sheep and the cattle lowing,
how nice.
And the sheep and the horses." You know, there's plenty of noise. But it's, you know, everything's the way it should be.
Yeah. That's beautiful, yes. The sheep are gambling, is that the word? There's life everywhere, but it's very sensitive life, not controlling life, you see, and not putting others down or anything like that. Thank you. And so, verse 9, "For the house of Yahweh our God, I wish you well." Jeremiah, "Who will have pity on you, Jerusalem? Who will bemoan you? Who will turn aside to ask about your welfare?" And Baruch was the scribe or secretary of the prophet Jeremiah, the priest. And the book of Baruch comes from much later, but they like to do this in the scriptures. They take known or famous figures from the past and they become the author of some poem or short story, or, you know, they did it with Jonah. They're doing it all the time. And that's lovely, really, because the key character is someone that everybody knows from the past. But it's a rewriting of something. Well, here in the book of Baruch, "God will give you evermore the name Righteous Peace, Godly Glory." And I'll finish from Luke, which actually has the weeping of Jesus over the city, because it does fit with some of those readings, I think. "As Jesus came near and saw the city, he wept over it, saying, 'If you, even you, had only recognized on this day the things that make for peace.'" He's also playing on the name. "But now they're hidden from your eyes. Indeed, the days will come upon you when your enemies will set up ramparts around you and surround you and hem you in on every side. They will crush you to the ground, you and your children within you, and they'll not leave within you one stone upon another, because you did not recognize the time of your visitation from God." And don't make the mistake that some people make. I used to make it hundreds of years ago, and you wouldn't blame me for doing it, I'm sure. You know, that Jesus has got this extra bit of information because he's God. If you mix up the divine being with the mind of Jesus, you end up with no incarnation, no humanity, nothing. Do you know what I mean? You've mucked up the whole show. Jesus is human. Human in his heart, human in his mind, human in every single part of it. And so if our major faith, which is that we call it the incarnation, is central to our Christian understanding, that the divine actually became human. It didn't take on human and then mix the two up and with and having an advantage, you know, as though Jesus has got an extra little brain somewhere that enables him to see what's going to happen in the future. He doesn't see the future any more than you do. But you don't have to see the future to say that. Look at it carefully. He could see, and he wasn't the only one who could see what was going to come. Can't we see sometimes the things that are going to come if we go ahead the way we're going? Couldn't people see Nazi Germany developing? Not everybody, but couldn't some see it? Couldn't some see the final solution coming? And others were thinking, oh no, that couldn't happen. So Jesus is saying to them, look, this is a beautiful time, but the Romans are still not listening. The Jews aren't listening. The Sicarii aren't listening. The Pharisees aren't listening. And because you're not listening to love and you're not willing to give it a go, you're hurtling on to this dreadful thing that's blindingly obvious to anyone whose eyes are pure and has a look. Human eyes looking. That's the end of the psalm, and I've just got a little thought here for you, and there's no way of doing it now with time that's available to us. But you can at least think of the idea of going to the book of Revelation, which likens the book of Revelation's beautiful, simple book, quite complex until you get the key. And I dare to say that I did find the key when I was in Rome from this wonderful Argentinian-Italian, Ugo Vanni, who had a lovely mind and a lovely simplicity. And he did about five little passages, no more than 15 verses, I think, of the book of Apocalypse. But in the way he did it, this little student sitting there thought, I've got it, you know, the key. It was the way he did it that made me think, so then I went away, and of course in my obsessive manner, I've got notes up that high in my room on the book of Apocalypse, Greek, everything. Because once you get the sniff of something, you know what to do, you go for it. Well, I do anyhow. And so I've produced a little thin volume on the Apocalypse, which I think it stands. I can't do it any better. And anyway, what am I telling all that for? Just the book of the Apocalypse is all about the church. It's all about Sunday, 8:30 Mass here on Sunday morning. That's what it's about. Or whatever time you have it at Page. You know, it's the local community. The New Jerusalem isn't some fancy thing up in heaven that's going to appear and come down to earth. All this mythical language. Mythical language worked once, when we weren't educated. And it's beautiful. Mythical language is so powerful and and still affects us. But I refuse to believe that once you start to thinking, you've got to stop to be religious. Do you know what I mean? Your brain has to keep working. And you can't, once you've asked a question, people can't say that's a silly question. You've got to answer it. And so today, the church is not going to appeal to anybody unless it's seen to be reasonable. Oh dear, I hope I don't go too much on this, but I was reading just something brief the other day. We're waiting, John the 23rd, we're waiting for a miracle, so God will do something to show us that John the 23rd was a saint. A miracle, meaning something that all the doctors will get together and say, no, you can't explain this by nature, so that'll get him a saint. So I'm asked to believe, by my beautiful church that I love, that God is going to intervene to fix up someone's leg somewhere at a prayer so we know that John the 23rd's in heaven. My God, that is such drivel. I mean, I can't bear it, honestly, because if God is going to intervene to do that, why the heck doesn't God intervene to stop 40,000 people in Pakistan being killed in a... Do you know what I mean? It's just bizarre. I mean, it's just bizarre to think that God is jumping in into, because once you've got God intervening in history, doing this and doing that and doing this to satisfy some Roman blooming curia that the founder of the Opus Dei is a saint, or John the 23rd, we know John the 23rd is a saint, and presumably the Opus Dei know their founder is a saint. But, you know, that's enough. The Apocalypse is about you and me. It's about, and the author is saying, have a look at the people around you. They're broken, they're sinners, they're this, they're that, they're ordinary, but they know something and they're daring to try to love. And they're not just staying at home, bored to steers, and changing their boredom during the day for some kind of obsessive behaviour at night, do you know? They're living, they're giving it a go, and that's a beautiful, and it's the New Jerusalem, and it's splendid, and God loves it. Now, they talk about thrones of judgment, the beauty of the New Jerusalem, the 12 gates. But there's no temple needed anymore in this one because the temple is Christ. It's the temple. I saw no temple in the city, for its temple is the Lord God, the Almighty, and the Lamb. And you can have a Eucharist anywhere in the world. And then there are still people around who say, no, you've got to marry in the church. I don't go against that, but you've got to marry in the church because it's a sacred place. For some people, the garden is a sacred place. And I'm not saying go to the garden. And, you know, I can see why you'd come to the church, and I would encourage everyone to do it, because that's, maybe they see the Eucharist and the baptism. You know, it keeps a link in our life. It's a beautiful family home, That's the reason for coming, not because it's more sacred than anywhere else. And then you've got a problem today. What are we going to do with people who don't see it as sacred, but do see the river as sacred? Well, I say go to the river and marry them at the river. Meet people where they are and invite them to the next step. If people are living sexually prolific lives, well, invite them to a bit of fidelity. Don't tell them that's dreadful what you're doing, and this is dreadful too, but do it. Invite them to, then if they're faithful, you invite them to the next step of commitment. And then if they're committed, say, well, look, what about celebrating this as a sacrament? Oh, okay. And they celebrate, you know what I mean? Bring people from where they are, doing their best and making a mess maybe, to where we are, which is doing our best and making a bit of a mess, and then onwards towards sanctity. But if you tell someone who's broken a leg you should be running the 100 metres in 10 seconds, what are they going to do? They're going to think you're unreal, or they're going to just say, well, I can't do it, and just sit down and cry and go back to the pig yard and be done with it. We've got to... Pardon?
All they think are totally heartless.
Heartless, yeah. Take them where they are. Didn't Jesus do that? Please say yes. Well, what about, hasn't the church got to do that? And haven't we all got to do it? And hasn't it got to be seen to be doing that instead of condemning and from standing up and... Like there are people apparently who think they're better than other people. I can't even understand that. Well, maybe if you knew my history, you'd see why. But we're not better than anybody, are we?
No.
No, we're not. So why don't we just meet people where they are, and if we show them love, they might be attracted to it. You don't have to condemn, because people whose lives are in a mess know it. Don't kid me, they don't know it. And people who pretend to be happy, and if you don't believe me, become a priest and go to hear confessions for 50 years and you'll know. But the surface is never the real. People are aching inside and they're putting on an appearance, and good luck to them, trying to do their best, we all do it. But we've got to meet people where they are with love, and that's exactly what Jesus did. And when the church does anything else, it's phony, it's heretical, it's out of touch. And when the church talks about truth in an unloving way, don't listen. Don't listen, because it's not true. Without love, it's not true. So if the truth isn't spoken in love, it might happen to be correct, but it's not true.